listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. We're here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment. And each week on Connect the Dots, we connect the dots between your personal health and well-being and all that's going on in our larger, interconnected, what I call our total environment. So we talk about different facets of health, the health of our community, the health of our society, the health of food, water, air, and earth, and the health as well as the more healthy and health protective attitudes that we can carry, take resource in, and base our concern for the earth upon. So every week on the show, we talk to different thought leaders, scientists, authors, activists, filmmakers, poets, writers, and ordinary citizens who can share, different vantage points on all the things in our interconnected world that concern our and others' well-being. On today's show, I am delighted to welcome an author who will be talking to us about his new book. He's Ravi Chandra. He's a psychiatrist and writer based in San Francisco. A distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, he blogs for Psychology Today and the Center for Asian American Media, and he's also a published poet and essayist. Today we'll be talking about his book, Face Buddha, Transcendence in the Age of Social Networks, and we'll be talking about, some of the up and down sides of our, new virtual commons, social media. And so I just want to, welcome you and thank you for joining us today, Dr. Chandra, to Connect the Dots.
Thank you so much, Allison, and I appreciate the opportunity to be on your program.
Social media, Facebook, Twitter, I confess I participate far more in Facebook than Twitter because it's kind of really longer format for more in-depth conversation, but people have different preferences in terms of their social media. Social media is, a kind of great innovation. It's a great novelty. It's a way that people can connect. It potentiates all kinds of different things. And, it also has certain downsides, which we can discuss on the show. As a user of social media as well as an observer from a psychological perspective of social media use, you've written your book, Face Buddha. And can you just kind of give us a basic sense of, what you see as the upsides and downsides?
Well, sure. I think, first of all, there's good and bad in everything, and ultimately we all have to make our own decisions about how we want to use our time, how we want to find connection, how we want to press for change, activism, and so forth. We all have to adapt in some way. I remember right around 2003, a lot of my friends were getting involved in Friendster, and I didn't really participate because I was actually a little paranoid, and I thought, maybe this was overly paranoid. I thought, we're just going to get on this social network, this Friendster, and then the government is going to know who your friends are, and then there'll be some kind of blowback or something. And that was, maybe the paranoia I was carrying around the lead up to the Iraq War. But lo and behold, 5 years later, I was, traveling in this Facebook is primarily a memoir about how I got onto Facebook, what I discovered there, and what I learned about myself and my own values. And so when I was in Vietnam, I was traveling on a five-month sabbatical across Asia to learn about the history of Buddhism and war and peace across these countries over the last century. And in Hanoi, a friend of a friend invited me to her birthday party on a rooftop. And it was just this magical evening under the stars. And I sat down to a lovely woman sat down next to me. And we had this wonderful, engaging conversation. It was just this little slice of heaven. And it was just so beautiful. And then I had to leave. My flight was the next day, and she kind of said, "Oh, are you on Facebook?" And I said, "Facebook? What's that?" I'd heard of Facebook before, but I hadn't really gotten onto it for the same reasons. I just wasn't that interested. But because of this conversation with this wonderful woman, I got on it, and then I had hundreds of friends already waiting for me. They were already into it, and I really plunged into it, and I enjoyed so much of it, started talking to people, joining groups, and I really got a big lift during Linsanity, which was Jeremy Lin in 2012, I believe it was. He had this 25-game winning streak with the New York Knicks, and this was just this phenomenal emotional contagion where the whole Asian American community, as far as I could see, or most of it, was just lifted by this incredible rise in of an Asian American basketball star. I mean, there was Yao Ming before, but he was Chinese. I mean, many of us were excited about Yao Ming as well, but this was different. So that was a beautiful burst of community excitement. And then there's, of course, you know, there are difficult conversations that we try to have on Facebook. So I'm kind of carrying my kind of spiritual values of connection, of wanting to have deep, meaningful relationships. And I'm also kind of seeing what's happening on Facebook. Sometimes it's good, but sometimes I would emerge from my time on Facebook wondering what had happened. I had faced ambivalence or some kind of disorientation. Where did the time go? Where is my mind now? And I needed to explore what was going on. So I started reading the psychological research that had been done about Facebook, and most of it has been done about Facebook, and really kind of discovered that the things I was experiencing had, you know, largely been documented and in the research already. I mean, things like depression, comparison, jealousy, envy. I mean, all these micro emotions that I experienced, which were very kind of disturbing to me because they didn't fit with my, you know, my sense of who I was, were disturbing. So over time, and then also, I just, you know, all this time I'm meditating and trying to cultivate myself, deepen myself spiritually and so forth. So that's a sideline. But, you know, I care about social issues. I've written about social issues and domestic violence and racism and all of that in my blogs and in my essays. So I carry that. But I find it hard to kind of just express. I mean, my views are maybe more complicated and more nuanced than what is really available for me anyway for expression on a social media platform. And I would find that people in my community anyway tend to become very polarized about these issues. There's right and wrong, and you know, I have a saying from psychiatry. One of my mentors told me, you can be right or related. You can be right or happy. And because, you know, the truth, is complicated. And sometimes it's good to call out bad behavior. Sometimes we have to call in with compassion. And I think we can only do that in the real world. So when I got really bogged down in these kind of back and forth polarizations, it was deeply frustrating to me. And there was another factor of, you know, when I scroll in a news feed, I would notice a little frustration, and I just explored that. And I finally found that it was because I really wanted to interact with everybody, that I really wanted to say something, to like something, or to interact with them. That was just part of me. Maybe I'm too attached to people in some way, or maybe something they said was annoying to me, but I wanted to get deeper into it. I don't know. But I found I was building up this residue of resentment about it. And actually, I'm not alone, because there was a man who invented a bot to like everybody's posts on Facebook. And, you know, because he felt frustrated, too, by feeling like he wasn't doing his part for his friend group. And finally, Facebook found out about that, and they shut it down. So this is the thing we often carry as human beings. We have this wish for a deeper connection, and sometimes this aura of connection and this the level of interaction we can have on Facebook can be satisfying. I'm not saying it's all bad. You know, to bring together groups that are geographically disparate and to bring together interest groups, okay, that's fine. But if you're looking for something deeper, where do you find that? And I'm still looking for that. I'm still trying to find that and construct that in my life. And I, for me personally, I didn't find that Facebook helped me in that deeper goal, ultimately. So that's kind of the arc of my narrative. Yeah.
That's really interesting. Can I ask you, you know, how many Facebook friends, for example, you have, and maybe what the composition of the, you know, like how do you sure. connect with people, and you know, how would you describe cohort
yeah.
there?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I would say it's a predominantly Asian American community I have on Facebook, although you know it is mixed, but it's predominantly Asian American. I'm in San Francisco, and I've done a lot of time in the Asian American community, Asian American art circle and activist circle. And so this is, and also disparately, you know, there's, you know, since I've been involved in writing my blog for Psychology Today, there's people who are involved in the media and other bloggers and so forth in the Asian American community. So this is the broader friend group. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's about 680 people or so. Yeah.
Mhm. Mhm. Right. Yeah. You know, I'm just asking because there could be, you know, kind of shared values or feelings about communicating that could be, you know, true of your group and not true of, you know, some other group or other groups, you know, whatever. I'm just trying to get a sense if, you know, being circumspect or being too busy to have time to read or you know, what other factors could impact your experience? I mean, I'm just wondering about that.
No, yeah, I mean, that's potentially a bit of a stereotype. I mean, these friends are not circumspect. They're very outspoken. They're very thoughtful and, you know, especially online. I think mm-hmm. so Facebook gives an outlet for all of that. I don't know what all of them are like in their real lives, but certainly I see a lot of outspoken, funny, from everything uh-huh. from funny to it's very open. I think, you know, or just very deep, you know, talking, sharing their, you know, struggles, their illnesses. I mean, this is, I don't think that's substantially different. However,
uh-huh.
maybe there are certain issues that people feel very strongly about. For example,
mm-hmm.
racism. I feel very strongly about racism as well. But
mm-hmm.
maybe I have a more kind of nuanced view. And maybe that's not understood by my community. I'm not sure. So something's not right. Or maybe I can't explain my nuanced views properly on Facebook in a way that really gets support. Because, you know, if when you disagree with somebody's argument or you add a nuance, your comments aren't really liked. In person, when you're talking with somebody, you can kind of negotiate. You kind of offer things in a gentle way or to bring each party to greater depth. I can do that.
Mm-hmm.
I hope better in person, but it's hard to do that nuanced conversation online. I don't think that's true just of Asian American communities. I think that from what I've heard from my patients, et cetera, this happens largely across the board. You know, there are some people who struggle admirably. I have a friend, a Jewish friend in Israel who works in Gaza, and she's a therapist, and she does amazing things, but she raises issues, and then she gets a lot of blowback, and she does her best to moderate this, and I just so admire her ability to hold that tension, but I think it's very painful to hold that tension, and I don't know. I mean, I never asked her how she does it, but I would really like to know. I mean, I don't even know if she's still on Facebook, but maybe, you know, Israel has different, you know, you argue hard and you still you still end up being friends. I don't know how it works in Israel. I mean,
mm-hmm.
you know, I have my what I've heard. But here, I don't know. I mean, it seems like you have an argument and then people don't talk to you. I mean, you know, I don't know. It's a different culture.
yeah, that can happen.
So,
definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, do you think it's therefore, you know, that it's more prone to boxing gloves off or, you know, the mitigating sense of the other person in their reality, you know, might be easier to connect with in person? I mean, what do you think? And to what extent is it, in fact, the, you know, the challenging political climate of this country, you know, where there are these views that are quite polarized, even without, I mean, I don't think Facebook alone is responsible for that polarization,
yeah.
but, you know, it's certainly yeah. occurring in an environment where there is that polarization.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, there's been polarization for over 30 years in this country, and plus longer than that. The political parties change every 8 years. Since Nixon, every 8 years, there's a big swing back and forth, and now we're at this huge swing to whatever we want to call it. I don't know. I don't even want to call it Republicanism. It's not. It's something very different. So there's that polarization, but I don't know why that's going on. What are the deeper reasons for that? There's very complicated. Maybe Facebook, and then there was 9/11, so another deeply polarizing, frightening to many Americans, many people around the world, and angering and so forth. And then, so I think Facebook, you know, in terms of the American psyche, maybe Facebook appeared as a patch to regenerate some kind of trust, but also along with trust comes control. So is it, you know, is it that in the wake of 9/11, do we need to find ways to build trust, or do we need to find ways to control and manipulate? So I think both things are happening at the same time, as we've seen. And so, you know, so I think the patch may not be, it may be something that was offered as a possibility, but maybe we have to work on trust and a deeper sense of our mission and our, even I would say, and I know everybody has different spiritual views, but I think ultimately we are involved not just in a political struggle, but in a spiritual and moral struggle that goes to the very core of what it means to be a human being living in this world. And I mean, just like, you know, Colin Kaepernick, you know, some people, you know, I think he's a hero, some people say, oh, he doesn't vote. He doesn't vote. So how can we, you know, we don't really like him anymore. I mean, I've heard that argument. And I think that's beside the point. I think Colin Kaepernick is the man of the century because he knows this is not just about politics. It's not just about who you vote for. This is about who we are as human beings. So that's what I mean by a deep moral and spiritual struggle that we have to come to terms with, how we think about each other, how we accept each other, how we love each other. That's the struggle that I am called to by people like Colin Kaepernick.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think all those questions are on the table. So, you know, I think part of this is we have, I just want to kind of inject, you know, a slightly different perspective, you know, because it's almost, you know, to say we're in a societal evolution and moment, you know, that are incredibly difficult and dangerous. I think, you know, many people are aware of this. And, you know, I personally don't believe that, you know, it kind of went back and forth between, you know, the Democrats and the Republicans, and it kind of went back and forth, and then suddenly a monster appeared, you know.
Right, exactly.
Subscribe to that. You know, there are things in, you know, there's been a devolution evolutionary trend in social caring and ethical sense of equity and justice and respect and care for, you know, one's fellow human being over, you know, that has been gradually, you know, moving, devolving, I would say, progressing isn't really the right word, over many years. And now we're hitting a moment. And so then we have, you know, this Facebook opportunity to, you know, share, compare, get to know, and potentially seek ways to remediate the situation. But it also has potentially some downsides. And I think the downsides that interest me the most are the social repercussions, as opposed to, you know, and I realize you're a psychiatrist, as opposed to, you know, the purely psychological ones. So, for example, you know, facing up to the different policy initiatives and their implications, you know, ones that multiple ones per day, you know, bombarding us in, you know, that are really out of sync with most likely from what we know from, you know, polls and research, what the majority of Americans think and want. So, you know, we have a small minority making these horrible policy decisions and, you know, that will have long-term consequences. And I think that anybody that is tracking those, and I know this because I'm part of networks of people who do track these things from health, environmental, food supply, democracy, and other perspectives. So people who track it would inevitably become disheartened, which is different, for example, than a clinical diagnosis of depression. But, you know, it's certainly possible that our interaction with others on Facebook could either, you know, kind of help us feel a sense of common purpose, or could become divisive, you know, depending on whose one group is and who you're talking to and what you're saying and how you're saying it. All those factors would enter in. But, you know, it's actually the social circumstances that are incredibly disheartening, I think.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. And for, you know, I just want to say at the outset, and I should have said this before, I don't know all the answers for everybody. I mean, you have to do what's right for you. And that's what I talk about in my book. We each have to come to our own adaptation to our own circumstances and what we need to work on whatever suffering or whatever issue or whatever need we have, whether it's belonging, whether it's activism or whatever. We need to find the tools within ourselves and in the world to do that. And so, and you know, but I think, you know, maybe have a seed of a vision for what the world should look like in the end. And maybe there, and I think that's, for me, it's a sense of common humanity, that we're all at the core, whatever facades, whatever power structure we've kind of adopted, you know, everybody ultimately, I think, is vulnerable. We live, we die, we are prone to illness. All of these basic human qualities, sometimes, you know, even this uncertainty, the basic uncertainty of life. I mean, that's at the core of our vulnerability. That's really what's there underneath everything. And if we forget that, if we think, if we totally forget, I mean, then we've got to fight. Of course, we've got to argue and debate and all of this. But if we forget that underneath it all, we're still human beings, then I think we're just going to perpetuate another kind of problem, you know.
And how does Facebook perhaps lead us to forget that? Obviously, it is not the same as an embodied interaction with somebody in person.
Yeah.
So what is, from your perspective, going on when we're having these virtual interactions?
Well, you know, for me, first of all, you're depending on an algorithm to mediate your contact with other people. So we should question that. Are your posts shared by other people? You know, will they read your comment? You know, I mean, it's so crazy, that we expect the algorithm to work. I mean, there's something wrong with the algorithm of the world, and we're trying to solve it with the algorithm on a server somewhere. I mean, this is kind of screwed up. This is the deeper algorithm of the world. That's what we really need to worry about. Why are things the way they are? There's something really messed up in the code of the world. So whoever's working on the code of the world, you know, I wish they would debugging. So we need some serious, like, big-time world debugging.
Who is working on the debugging or coding of the world?
I don't know. Maybe we have to. Maybe we have to. I'm just speaking comically, but
metaphor.
Yeah, I don't know. I think maybe we all are in our deepest part of our souls that we're not even aware of. Paul Simon has a song that says something like, "It's a thing that I do in the back of my head." It's on Graceland, and so maybe this deep coding is something that's happening in the deepest part of our subconscious, our collective unconscious, and we have to really, really work on ourselves through our relationships to really allow that to rise, and so we can really examine it and decide, make choices for who we want to be individually and collectively. So maybe that's where our communal debugging has to happen. On the subconscious biases, on the way we hold what we believe we want the world to be. I mean, that's basically what I'm talking about.
It's interesting, because, like, you know, there's the subconscious biases, that, in other words, that we may not know about, and then there's the unconscious actions,
right.
Of all different types, and So I guess my question is: do you think that there, you know, that Facebook is, what is the range of, stating humanization, as being kind of the path toward a more sustainable, just, equitable world, is Facebook helping, us connect and put a face on, people that we might not encounter in our local daily lives in a way that's furthering that? Or is the disembodied quality and the overall societal polarization that's expressed on Facebook defeating that or undermining that? Or how does that work in your opinion?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Facebook is a lot of things. I mean, on the one level, it's something that creates belonging. Another, it allows for self-expression, although that's all dependent on the algorithm. And on the other level, it's a surveillance machine. So, that's there to monetize your relationships, at the very least monetize your relationships. And possibly, as we've seen with Cambridge Analytica, the possibility to manipulate people. So what is Facebook? I think we're still working that out. Everybody has to kind of think about what they want to trust for Facebook. But for me, my deepest moments of connection have been in the real world, when I'm having I mean, I feel like we're having a pretty deep conversation. Maybe it could be even more deep if it was face-to-face. But it allows for the nuance. It allows for the tone of voice. It allows for this complex interchange. So conversation and presence and just being with other people, you get a sense of each other, and you grow in a sense of trust. This person, Allison, she's really thoughtful. She thinks about things in a much bigger way than I do, of course, because you are who you are. You have your experience. You have your full identity and individuality. And I'm sharing a bit of my individuality as well. And maybe through those kinds of deep interactions, we come to something deeper. And or maybe just enjoying each other's presence. I mean, those, just you know, enjoying some conversations or laughter. That's so powerful for me. I mean, it's like little slices of heaven amidst the chaos of the world, where there's this cataclysmic barrage of trauma, you know, that's going on every day in people's lives.
Yep.
And on Facebook, sometimes it becomes this barrage, and I you know, it's like it's so disorienting to me. I don't know how to do it. Sometimes I have to disconnect from even watching the news because it's too much. How do we? For me, I just have to kind of keep, you know, I watch the news regularly. I'm not disconnected. I care, but I have to come back to center too. I personally
avoid as much as possible watching the news. I instead read the news because even if the news is unpleasant or difficult, I find that watching moving images and people talking right to you through the medium of television is far more, it has higher manipulative power than when you're taking it, you know, through the linear narrative word stream, and you can stop and start, you know, reading something, and you don't have the embodied power of a charismatic individual putting forth their frame to you. You have more control and capacity for reflection and distancing, if needed, you know, from the written words. So, you know, some of the things that, in terms of what increases polarization, and I say this as a longtime member of the media, you know, I think the media plays a really big part, you know, before we get to the tools, you know, like social media that disseminate the media. And I also just have observed over many years, and this, there's no study of this. I wish there was, actually. But, you know, people who regularly watch a lot of television news, whatever the political persuasion, you know, really adopt. They develop They develop an acceptance as, you know, what people say or what people think or, you know, what the given truth is, they develop a strong acceptance, a very uncritical acceptance of whatever side of the polarization they happen to be on. And so then, in effect, it has an authoritarian function because then people feel like they are belonging to a group that speaks with a certain authority, and therefore, you know, has the right on their side, whichever side that may happen to be, you know. And I find that the people who regularly watch television of any kind, pretty much, are the more persuaded and embedded and polarized beliefs. And, you know, Facebook audiences may divide by algorithm among those groups, and, you know, cross conversations of various kinds and sharing of nuances is, in my view, always better. But so if I were looking for culprits in our dilemma of polarization, I would kind of posit that media, and specifically television news media, play a very major role in that. And then we just see it kind of playing out through the algorithms and the self-selection of people on Facebook.
Right. Well, that's kind of like that's part of the bigger algorithm, right? And you're right. It's like what narrative is being enforced, et cetera. That's why some people turn to Fox News because they don't want to believe, you know, whatever's popular or whatever. I do watch TV news from time to time. I switch from different channels. I'm most regular with the PBS NewsHour because I feel like it's kind of comforting to me to see familiar faces warmly interacting and having conversations. You know, that feels comfortable to me. Occasionally I'll watch Amy Goodman, but, you know, sometimes it's hard because it's a lot of difficult material, and that's also a very it's also a narrative, a very specific ideological narrative, which is important, but sometimes I need to see things from more points of view. And then sometimes I'll watch the network news just to see what's in the kind of the zeitgeist, as they put it. So, you know, I'll go back and forth, and I read the New York Times and some other papers as well from time to time, and some magazines. So I try to take in things, but I know that I could be in danger of not hearing the important and most strident voices. That's my kind of, maybe a blind spot. So thank you for reminding me of that. And I've got to keep myself tuned, you know, as a human being, tuned to the ground of what's going on in the world.
But, let me ask you a question as a psychiatrist, which is a little bit off our topic, but it's kind of really more how our conversation is veering. For many years, I was one who at a certain period of life turned off the TV set, turned off all news, you know, as a kind of health-oriented approach, you know, to stress management. And this was actually widely counseled. As a health reporter, I myself offered, you know, these suggestions, and it's probably the most widespread general advice when people are overwhelmed by what's going on in our society. But, you know, what we tend to think is, and that's why I specifically counsel that people not watch television, you know, because that will also both sort of solve the problem but also overwhelm you with the belief system. But,
sure.
You know, but the,
well
but the question is, what can people do? Because it's not either the media or the social media, although they each may play roles in our devolving situation here. But it's the society at large, you know, that's going through this difficult passage. And it is indeed overwhelming to see the number of things that are being undone or, you know, kind of, or done, depending on which side of it you're looking
at. Right, exactly.
Yeah, so, I mean, what can people do? I mean, I think Facebook may, in fact, play a role in helping people manage their stress together. Because if you go into your community and perhaps try to find people, you know, who are following what you're following or on the same page as you, you may be a little hard-pressed to find them, perhaps. But if you go into social media, you kind of can find people who are, and, you know, yes, we're not engaging in a debate with the other side when we're kind of comforting each other about, you know, how disturbing we perceive something to be. But, you know, do you think there's a social support function?
Especially if you're living in an isolated, an area where you feel isolated culturally, politically, or with, you know, you have a disability, you can't leave the house. I mean, you know, there are so many reasons why a device, an app can help you find connection, a form of connection. I don't want to play that down. So that's why it's all up to you. You know, it really is. But I think, you know, I wonder what's the bigger reason? Why is it so hard if you have different politics with somebody? Why is it so hard to communicate with somebody with a different political system belief? I mean, that's like the human question. Why do we take our ideas so seriously that it becomes hard, that we berate and devalue and don't trust people who don't believe in guns? I mean, how do we get to the place where we can see each other as human beings? We might have different values, but maybe we really have to engage in some deeper way because we're disconnected. Maybe we get so trapped in our ideas, and maybe that's the part of the code that I'm talking about, the global code, is that everybody gets caught up in their ideas and their opinions, and they forget about what it means to be a human being, relating to another human being. And I think that's something that's very hard. I can't presume I know how other people can create that in their lives, But I would suggest that, well, there's a Chinese fable about the nail that gets lost. And because the nail was lost, the horseshoe fell off. And because the horseshoe fell off, the horse was lost. Because the horse was lost, the battalion was lost, and so on and so on and so on until the war is lost. So that's what I feel like sometimes in the world, that somewhere along the line, we've dropped a nail. Maybe, you know, deep in the core of it, we were unkind to each other in some way. We decided to create a division between us as human beings because there were different priorities or because there was prejudice or whatever. And that's the nail that has fallen out on the world. And we've somehow got to decide, oh, wait a minute, that nail dropped off, but we still want to win this war of being human, of love, of being really a beloved community, as Martin Luther King said. So that's for me, is like I'm just trying to do my part to just add a little bit of whatever it is I bring to the world. And, you know, I think other people can find their own way to do that. And I know it's super hard. If you're, you know, people around you are obnoxious and devaluing and self-centered, that is the hard work. Someone told me, you're asking, I did a support group for activists, and one of the young people said, aren't you asking us to do emotional labor? And this is kind of a Marxist view of things, I think. I mean, it's kind of, you know, interesting, but it's true. It's hard work to, and I wouldn't say how to hold that. I mean, sure, we have to set boundaries with people who really harm us, but also I think, you know, finding at least a seed of kindness or compassion for someone you disagree with, finding just a seed, and maybe that's enough to start a conversation. And there are studies that show this, if you can actually with a 20-minute conversation about, this was a study about transgender issues, a 20-minute conversation which provided empathy and understanding and really seeing things from the other person's perspective, it actually could change the person's point of view. So that's, you know, that's amazing to me, that you can really we can influence each other by being reasonable and by being empathic and by really understanding and by really considering the possibility that we might be wrong in their point of view, and you know, just really understanding their point of view. So I think that for me, that only happens in the real world. But I agree, it's super hard and super complicated.
I've had experience. I mean, I've seen that going on Facebook, and it's I moderate a lot of conversations on Facebook, and you know, people. I mean, I sometimes try to open. I did this recently. I try to open up an unpopular view on something, just so, you know, we kind of are holding a bigger space around an issue. And I did that the other week. And, you know, I got a lot of people who really appreciated it, a lot of people who gave me a lot of flack for it. There were dialogues and debates among people on the thread. It was really, you know, but just creating more space around the topic, I just felt that it was useful. And which brings me to a question, because in this particular topic, I mean, one of the things that I think happens a lot is that we're seeing so much greed, predatory behavior, uncaring behavior, outright harm, and devastation, economic, you know, material, biological, you know, murder even, you know, in our larger world going on. And so, you know, there's a lot of perpetration. We don't want to become numb to it. We don't want to normalize it. We don't want to deny it. We don't want to become anxious and fearful. completely, you know, in a state of constant rage around it, all of these kind of things. And that's really, I mean, if I just, I'm just kind of summarizing what I consider the biggest stressors in our world. So, you know, how do people cope with that? Because, you know, they're all, you know, many people are feeling this.
Well, I get angry. These things bother me deeply. But where does our, you know, online anger spreads more virally than any other emotion. And then it can just become this, you know, and then where does it go? And I don't know. I don't know where those other individuals on social media take their own anger personally. It could be that it's entraining anger as a habit against everything that that is not acceptable. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I think we as human beings are perhaps more nuanced than that. We can be angry about some things, but also maybe see a deeper ways to deal with them as well. And I agree, there are predators. A homeless woman shouted at me on the street the other day, "What's going on in this community? Is there sickness or are there bastards?" And I thought to myself, see, all of the above, you know, that was like a pretty wise woman kind of, right, message from the universe, right? So there was sickness and there are bastards. We just got to be aware of it. And
I really love that. That's really funny. That's God, isn't that amazing? Yeah, that you could almost I mean, that's worthy of a meme on Facebook. That's a good one. That just came right to you. Yeah.
Well, I put it in. You might want to read my film festival blog about Norman Mineta. It's called Norman Mineta and the American Psyche. But there was a documentary that premiered at the Asian American Film Festival about the life of Norman Mineta. Everybody hopefully can find out who he is. He's been just a tremendous person, but a real person of integrity. So I wrote about the film and about what the question that I asked. But basically, I don't know if we have time to tell that little story, but
We may have time for that.
Yeah.
I just want to take a pause right here to let our listeners know that we're talking with Rava Chandra, psychiatrist and writer and the author of the book Face Buddha, Transcendence in the Age of Social Networks. And your website where people can read your blogs and find, you know, more information about your book, possibly link through to purchase it, where can we send people?
Okay, so the website for the book is facebuddha.co, face, facebuddha.co, and the website for my general writing and everything else is ravichandramd.com.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, great. I just wanted to say that parenthetically. We have about another 7 or so minutes to the show, so if you'd like to tell that story, go for it.
Yeah, so the film about Norman Mineta, documentary by Diane Fukami and Deborah Nakatomi, really fantastic 1 hour documentary about Norman Mineta's life. His parents were immigrants from Japan in the 1920s, and despite the Alien Exclusion Act of 1924, established their roots. As many of you know, Japanese Americans, including his family, were interned in concentration camps during the World War II. They emerged and he emerged from that. He was very determined, very charismatic and very determined individual. He was kind of recruited to be a politician. He was in insurance, but he was recruited to be a politician, became mayor of San Jose for 2 terms as Silicon Valley started to rise, but really had a caring heart and pushed for things like curb cutouts to help disabled access and so forth. And then became, after the Nixon impeachment and resignation, he was part of a big wave of Democrats elected to Congress and served for many terms as a congressman, ultimately, you know, helping to pass the H.R. 442, the Redress and Reparations Bill for Japanese Americans, and then became Secretary of Commerce under Bill Clinton and Secretary of Labor under George Bush. So a very accomplished man. And so the film told his story. And so I went up and asked Ms. Secretary Mineta, thank you for your life of ongoing service. What have been the seeds of your resilience, and how have you avoided in your rise to power disillusionment and corruption? And so the whole auditorium kind of broke out in laughter, because I think there's a subtext to how have you avoided corruption. But he said basically that my father told me that there are two things that you have that no one else can take from you. It's your name and your reputation. And that stuck with me. And he said Dan Inouye also had the same thing. Dan Inouye, when he was going off to war, his father told him, Dan Inouye, senator from Hawaii, went off to war in HR in the 442nd, the most decorated American regiment, composed all of Japanese Americans. But his father told him, do nothing to disgrace your family, the country, or the Japanese American people. So, I mean, this kind of greater responsibility. There's also a sense of a huge amount of self-restraint, which is, I mean, that's hard. I mean, we're all human beings. To be self-restrained in that way can be very hard. It can also be very invigorating and deepening to do that. But this is the kind of that's the character of an American hero. And then afterwards, I walked out of the party, and this woman, and this homeless woman, shouted, what's wrong with this community? Is there sickness, or are there bastards? So it's like kind of brought together everything. Yeah. So.
Wow. Yeah, that's. It's important to ask these questions, just to help people keep on, even in the face of, these mounting obstacles, without a doubt. Do you see in your own practice, I don't know what kind of practice you have, but do you see in your own practice the impact of these social problems on your client population?
Sure. I think certainly gender discrimination and sexism, misogyny come up very frequently, and racial issues as well. I think those are common. Issues in the workplace. These things come up in subtle and not so subtle ways. Also, just parental pressures and kind of parental. Demands, particularly on women, these come up quite frequently.
So, I mean, what is your position today? I mean, have you left social media? Do you use it intermittently? Or, what are you doing yourself now, having had these insights?
Well, I had deactivated Facebook for 3.5 years, kind of lightly had been on Twitter. I reactivated Facebook to promote my book last fall, but, I'm finding it's not particularly satisfying. I think the algorithm has kind of forgotten me, and I don't think it's necessarily sharing my posts. So I think I'm about ready to deactivate again. And maybe use Twitter very lightly. I've deactivated the apps on my phone. So, so it's just, I think that feels better for me. Yeah. But I do have a page for my writing on Facebook. So, yeah.
And how do people find that?
If they go to ravichandramd.com, they can they can find all the links.
Oh, they can find the website we mentioned before. This has been, quite enlightening. I appreciate your perspective. And I just want to mention again to our listeners, we're talking with Ravi Chandra, MD, the author of Face Buddha, Transcendence in the Age of Social Networks. Thank you so much for being with us on today's Connect the Dots. It's been an interesting reflection on some of these issues as we kind of experience them in different places in our society. And, I think a reminder to kind of look at all of the things that we're kind of doing to ourselves or participating in, and whether they're optimal or non-optimal. I guess I have one tiny little question, which is, you express concerns about surveillance, and I, too, I share your concern about surveillance on Facebook, and yet I know many people who will ask personal questions or confide personal matters in Facebook Messenger. And, as a journalist, I'm sensitive to that and often feel, this is like telling the government your personal business. Why would you do that, there is a sense of, or maybe there isn't and should be, a sense of self-censorship in this forum, which goes to the root matter of trust you were mentioning. Any comments on that?
Yeah. Well, I'd say, we can't be, I'm personally not going to be paranoid about what I text or what I Facebook message, of this kind. I mean, what is someone going to do with it? I'm okay with all that. But, I think you have to figure it out for yourself. And I might be right or wrong about any of this stuff. And that's not the important thing. The important thing is that we all stay related. And that's the key,
Amen to that. Thank you so much, Ravi Chandra, for being with us today on Connect the Dots, and good luck with your book and your ongoing writing and contemplation for Psychology Today and other blogs. And thank you, listeners, for being with us this week. We'll be back next Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and, we have this kind of farewell salutation we do every week, which keeps getting changed and added to. So, head up with an open heart. Keep marching forward with all our relations. And there was me and there was I.